Hello, Sun's House listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for about a month, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Eats Your Peas, Julius. Even Caesar Must Clean His Plate. And then it's Seeking Shanti, a family story of climate migration. At Our Table, Eyes That Weave the World's Wonders, Amma Far Away. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Don't Wash Winston. So, it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book, Eat Your Peas, Julius. Even Caesar Must Clean His Plate. Time's up, little Julius. Put your game away. Your dad's having a banquet. You've a new role to play. For the first time this evening, you'll have your own seat, or rather a couch, as men lie down to eat. First, your toga proxtextra. Please hold still if you can. Over left arm, under right arm, see, you're almost a man. Clean your hands in rose water, so they're fragrant and sweet. Let them take off your sandals and wash your wee feet. Oh, here come the oysters, paraded in on their shells. Amidst a sea of smoked whole fish, how delightful that smells. Not tempting? Maybe something from the selection of fowl, peacocks, parrots, flamingos, but we're fresh out of owls. No fowl for you, Julius? You really must eat. Have some stuffed sow's udders or some boiled camel's feet. Here's a plate of sea scorpions, a sweet custard with fish, pig lungs stuffed with fresh figs, veggies, and brains in one dish. By love, sweet Julius, how you fuss about food. A little baked dormouse is a treat. Don't be rude. You should realize you're fortunate to have rodents at all. There are children without food in Clispin Gaul. Very well, little Caesar, because you said please, you're excused from the table, but first, eat your peas. Seeking Shanti, a family story of climate migration. Dear reader and new friend, our names are Sandhya and Chaya Prabhat, and we are children's book illustrators originally from Chennai, India. A few years back in our hometown of Chennai, there was a huge flood, which was very scary for our entire city. The roads were unsafe due to extreme flooding, and people had to use boats to move around. Food supplies were short. There was a total power outage and no connectivity. Some people lost their homes to the water. But it was very moving to watch people from all walks of life, old and young, rich and poor, come together and share resources. Everyone shared food, rescued stranded animals, provided shelter to those who didn't have a place to stay. Things slowly picked up again, and the city was back to normal. From the fires and earthquakes in California to hurricanes and tropical storms in India, climate disasters affect us all. We were thrilled to be involved with the creation of Seeking Shanti. Sharing our stories and experiences with Jesse and Sandy, each of whom has also experienced personal loss due to climate crisis and displacement. Together, we wanted to show how important it is when disaster strikes to work together like Kavya, her family, and her community. In doing so, we can support one another during difficult times and change the world for the better. We're making a pact with you and the creative team behind Seeking Shanti to be prepared for a climate disaster. By preparing, we are doing what we can ahead of time. And by sharing information with our friends and family, talking about the climate crisis, and helping our neighbors when they are in need, we are keeping kindness and community at the center of what we do. Kavya bounces up and down as she races home from school. "I know I promised to teach you how to play fetch today, Saikai, and I will," she says. "I will do it as soon as I get back from the fish market with Baba." "Baba, where are the people?" "I'm not sure, Betta. The fish market in Shanti never closes this early." Baba frowns. "Maybe the rain scared them away," Kavya says. As Baba and Kavya head home, thunder booms, clouds burst with heavier and heavier rain. Kavya sees Daddy waving nervously from the shore. Daddy is dripping wet as she gives them the news. The rain was even louder now and sounded like hissing snakes. Kavya could only make out a few of Daddy's words because of the noise. "Arm is coming." Soon everyone started to grab different things. Dada grabs food. Baba grabs water. Daddy grabs clothes. And Kavya packs her most special thing. "We can't leave Saki, Baba. How will she make it through the storm alone?" Kavya begs as Sakai pulls on her backpack. "I'm sorry, Kavya. We can't take her. We need to hurry to meet your uncle before the rain gets worse," Baba answers. Kavya frowns and looks to Daddy for help. Baba looks at them both, sighs, then waves Sakai to the boat. As they sail down the rising river, they see a tree. The tree once stretched high into the sky, but now is sleeping on its side. "I'm going to help them move the tree," Baba yells. "Me too," Kavya adds. "How much longer until we get to Chakus?" Kavya asks. "I don't know. It may take longer to find our way with the sun going down," Baba replies. Suddenly, everything goes dark, like someone threw a thick blanket over the earth. "Kavya, sometimes the lights can go out during a storm," Baba explains. "But don't you worry. Keep your hand in mine and we'll be fine." Kavya squeezes Baba's hand with both of hers and shuts her eyes tight. When Kavya opens her eyes, she sees a beam of light cutting through the night. "Kachu! Let's push the jeep out of the mud," Kachu yells. As they try to move the jeep, Baba, Daddy, and Dada look as if they are being swallowed into a chocolate milkshake. "Baba, can I help?" Kavya shouts. Just as Kavya finishes her sentence, the front wheels grip. The jeep jerks forward and is finally set free. Airplanes roar through the night sky like a pack of growling dogs. Kavya looks out of the window to see her home racing by. As they drive further into the darkness, Kavya feels as if she is leaving a piece of herself behind. Kachu takes the family to a place where some people are crying and yelling. Some are sitting with other people and some are sitting alone. Baba whispers to Daddy and Dada as Kavya lies down. "I don't know if we'll ever get to go home." Baba teaches Kavya a trick to help pass time at the camp. Kavya teaches Sakai. "Great news," Chaku finally yells. "We can go back home to Shanti." Kavya wiggles with excitement on their drive back. But when she arrives home, it's different than she remembered. "I don't think we can fix this," Baba whispers. "Should we even try?" If Chaku's home is ruined too, where else will we go? Dottie asks. Kavya feels her stomach turn as she listens to their words. Our family has been here forever, Baba. This is home. Trip to the fish market. Dada, taking bananas to the temples every morning. Sake chasing me around the yard. Family dinners. Our memories with Ama, Karva cries. Baba still isn't sure if staying is the best thing to do. But, with a little help, they choose to stay and try to rebuild their home. Because, in the end, all they want is Shanti. Eyes that weave the world's wonders. Every year, my family poses for pictures, running and laughing and hugging and jumping, standing and squatting and smiling in matching clothes and matching shoes and matching laughter. Everyone matching in every way. Except me. No one in my family has eyes like mine. My mom has eyes like ocean waves, lapping at shores of sand that sparkle as they tumble with the tide. Her eyes fill with fire. When we wander halls of paintings and portraits, sculptures and scenery, she opens them wide and shares her soul with me in thick brush strokes and fine lines dipped in rainbows of color. When Mom looks at me, it's like she sees me for the first time. Every time, her eyes tell me I'm every wish she whispered into the evening air, a masterpiece, more magnificent than the dreams she clung to before I arrived. My dad has eyes like a golden summer garden, with golden sunflowers bursting between green leaves, always turning toward the light. His eyes bloom bright when we go to his secret spot, where the fish bite best. The stream speaks, the trees chatter, the animals amber by. And my dad says the fish are going to bite today, but his eyes say sharing this moment is magic he treasures more than all the fish in the world. Sometimes our lines get crossed, they twist and turn, and I don't know how to untangle every loop. My dad takes my hand, and his eyes tell me it will be okay. Some knots bind us with bonds more visible than blood. My parents' eyes don't look like mine, but through them I see a world full of wonder, a world that made us family. Still, I know somewhere there is someone who has eyes that kiss in the corners and glow like warm tea, just like mine. There are trinkets that traveled with me between lives, stories I've been told. So many times they've become memories I'm not sure are mine. A one-eyed rabbit with a yellow bow I used to match in size. A handmade hanbok with a sea-green skirt and sleeves the colors of sunrise. A cotton-white blanket that wrapped me in warmth as I watched myself rise to the skies. I wonder who and where and why and what if and what happened. All I know for sure is that tears can talk. And they tell me sometimes love must look like letting go. I've learned that eyes are for more than matching. I have eyes that spin stories and weave the world's wonders. My eyes fill with fire and bloom bright with light that bends through mist and dew. There are silk strands that soak up the sun and shimmer with the hues of hopes and dreams I braid into tales only I can tell. My eyes wrap the yarn of every story I know into the stitches of stories I don't. My questions are eyelets through which I tie the whispered wishes of the past to the fearless designs of my future. My eyes that spin stories and weave the world's wonders are connection. They are mom and dad and people I see in my dreams. They are me, and they are wonderful. Ama Far Away. Every Saturday, they connected by computer. Ama told stories to Kylie. Ama sang songs to Kylie. Ama showed snacks to Kylie, always speaking simply and slowly. But Kylie jittered and jiggled in her seat. Video chats weren't the same as real life. One lived in Taipei, one lived in San Francisco. Groan, why do we have to go? It's so far away. When they arrived at the Taipei airport, Ama! Kylie held tight to Mama with ears pricked. She listened to Ama talk. Kylie kind of understood. In Ama's apartment, everything seemed strange, yet the faces were happily familiar. Aunts, uncles, and cousins, actual or not, packed a banquet for Mama and Kylie. 10-12-person tables. And over 9 courses of steaming food. Gulp. Kylie ate rice. Finally, Taipei is so beautiful. Ama showed her the city she loved. Ama treated them to the Chinese donuts, Yoltaiyo, she delighted in. No frosting, no filling, no chocolate? Ama brought them to the park she enjoyed. Come play, Kylie eyed Ama sideways. Ama took them shopping at the night market, where she seemed to try and buy everything. Come see. Everywhere they went, Kylie trailed behind Ama and Mama. It was a brand new day, the day they visited the hot springs. Kylie changed. After she dipped a toe in the water, Ama beckoned. Come, come. Kylie loved splashing, and the water was warm. Should she? Could she? She could. She should. The water was warm, and Kylie loved splashing. Come, come. Kylie beckoned. Ama. After she dipped a toe in the water, Kylie changed. The day they visited the hot springs, it was a brand new day. Ama and Mama trailed behind Kylie everywhere they went. Come see. She seemed to try and buy everything at the night market where Ama took them shopping. Come play. Lai Wan. Kylie eyed Ama sideways. She enjoyed the parks. Ama brought them too. No frosting, no filling, no chocolate. She delighted in the Chinese donuts, Yoltaiyo, Ama treated them to. She loved the city Ama showed her. Taipei is so beautiful. Finally, Kylie ate rice, gulp, and over 9 courses of steaming food. 10-12-person tables, aunts, uncles, and cousins, actual or not, packed a banquet for Mama and Kylie. The faces were happily familiar, yet in Ama's apartment, everything seemed strange. Kylie kind of understood. Ears pricked, she listened to Ama talk with Mama. Kylie held tight to Ama when they arrived at the Taipei airport. It's so far away, groan, why do we have to go? One lived in Taipei, one lived in San Francisco. Video chats weren't the same as real life, but Kylie jittered and jingled in her seat, always speaking simply and slowly. Kylie showed snacks to Ama. Kylie sang songs to Ama. Kylie told stories to Ama. They connected by computer every Saturday. Kylie and Ama didn't visit each other often enough. 100 butterflies took flight in Kylie's belly. It'll be so fun. We get to see Amma and we can have an adventure. We can go to pretty new places. We can eat yummy new foods. Kylie squirmed. It was time for a visit. At our table. At our table, there is room for a fresh tablecloth, crisp and gold like this day. For helping hands to peel and fold and guide. For old traditions. And new ones, too. At our table, there is room to shift down, squeeze in, or share a seat. Room for every platter, plate, and bowl to pass from hand to hand, even without space for elbows. At our table, there is always room for quiet. Room to give thanks for the land where our food grew, and to the people who harvested it. Room to learn from the first farmers and builders and knowledge gatherers. Room to celebrate how they lead and care and share their gifts with the world. At our table, there is room to give to the earth, to our neighbors, and to our bellies. Room for mixed-up medleys, mashed potato mountains, and separated servings, for trying things, even when they are squishy, or runny, or new. At our table, there is room to be silly, or to be serious, or to stumble. Room for swapping stories, second helpings, and favorite jokes. There's always room to share, especially when it's hard. At our table, there is lots of room for dessert. And when pauses are long, and the last jackets are gathered, our table still has room for a folded tablecloth, one warm light from the kitchen, and a place to rest, knowing you are loved and feeling grateful. For feeling full. Don't wash Winston, and keep in mind that Winston is a teddy bear. Whenever Liam felt afraid, he turned to his best bear, Winston. They could always lean on each other. The pair's favorite game was Pie Factory. But one Saturday, while Liam was preparing a fresh batch of pie filling, Winston took a terrible tumble. Liam watched as his bear flipped, toes over nose, with a squish, squisho, flop. Oh, no! Winston needed washing. Not the washing machine. I can't go in there with you, Winston. We won't be together. And what if you don't come back? Plus, the washing machine is loud. It's big. And you'll be locked in a box full of water. I don't think so. Winston was not getting washed. Just remember, don't look down. You'll be safe up there. And he put him on top of the bird cage. But it wasn't long before his hiding place was discovered. There's his dad, and he grabs him. I have a better idea, Winston. And his dad is getting ready to put him in the washing machine. You'll be safe in here. And Winston shoved him in the doghouse. But he wasn't. Woof, woof, woof. Don't worry, Winston. I have a new place. And now it's time to get creative and make something with my bare hands. Snip, snip, one final piece to top it off, plus a snack, almost done. Ta-da! Liam had created the perfect disguise, and he dressed him up. It's pie time bar bear in, as they were returning to their stand. Liam slipped, then tripped, then toppled over, right into the puddle of filling. Oh, no. Liam needed washing. He hopped in the tub and scrubbed up all clean. That feels much better. Then he looked over at Winston. Liam realized what had to be done. It was time to face his fear and do what was best for his best bear. Winston really needed washing. "I'll be right here waiting the whole time," said Liam. Winston was finally washed. They put him in the washing machine. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with Fun in the Mud, a wetlands tale. Wetlands are magical places, and like all places of enchantment, they are deceptively simple and are easily overlooked. From the edge, they appear empty, just a vast expanse of grass and mud. But I have learned that if you go a few feet in from the edge, stepping your way from tuft to tuft of spongy grass, you enter a world of subtle, ever-changing beauty. The wetlands reward patience, so find yourself a spot to sit. And if you're quiet enough and still enough, long enough, you may catch a glimpse of the glistening of wings. Or you may hear the squelching of tiny feet in the mud. They may be the wings of dragonflies, or they may be the feet of newts. But if you are very, very lucky, and if the tide is just right, and if the wind is just so, you may even see a wetland fairy. It was on just such a day, with the tide far out to sea, and the breeze smelling ever so slightly of wildflowers, that I came toe to toe with Jack and Minnie. Now, the surest way to tell a wetland fairy from a run-of-the-mill fairy is to look at their feet. Wetland fairies have strong, sturdy feet with webs between each toe for balance. For, like all living things you will find in the wetlands, they are perfectly adapted to their magical, changeable, floodable home. And true enough, there stood two wetland fairies floating easily on top of the mud. "Well, hello there," Jack said. "Welcome to the wetlands. I'm Jack, and this is Minnie. How do you do?" "Nice to meet you," I replied. "I didn't know there were fairies in the wetlands." "Of course there are. No finer place for fairies, if you ask me," said Jack. "But what do you do? It seems so wet and muddy and, well, boring." "Boring," they laughed as they fluttered into the air, then settled down on the tips of the grass, swaying to and fro with the breeze. "There's fun all year in the wetlands, if you know where to look," Minnie said, smiling. "We were just on our way to the creek to go swimming with the smolts," Jack said. "The smolts," I asked, "are they fairies like you?" "Oh, no. They are the young salmon just coming down the river on their way to the ocean. The ocean is much saltier than the stream they were born in. So they live in the wetlands for a while to get used to it before swimming out to sea. They are young and frisky and fun," Minnie explained. "They will often let us hold on to a fin and give us a ride if we ask politely." "But what do you do after they are gone?" I ask. "Oh, by then it's summertime, and we go camping by the frog ponds. The sing-alongs at night are such fun. We can't sing underwater like the frogs can, but we can keep the beat with our wings." "That does sound fun." "But my favorite is the parade," cried Minnie, as she rose in the air and did loop-de-loops before landing delicately back on a blade of grass. "There's a parade in the wetlands?" "Oh, the pickleweed parade, to be precise," Jack insisted. "Every fall, when the pickleweed puts on its brightest, reddest colors, thousands of birds fly overhead, and the parade lasts for weeks," exclaimed Minnie. "But," Jack said, "that's not really the best." "What could be better than that?" I asked. tall tide tales. What exactly are tall tide tales? Well, when the storms blow in, the birds meet on that grassy mound over there and wait out the storm by telling the tallest, high tide tales you've ever heard. The laughter drowns out the sound of the wind, so quicker than you can imagine. The high tide is over and everyone is safe to go down into the wetlands again. Just then, I noticed that the ground around my feet was wet, and I could hear water creeping up the side of the bank. The tide was coming in. And then I noticed Jack and Minnie. As the tide rose around them, they grew darker, and they were plumping up and up and up until they looked like they were going to pop. Just when I thought they couldn't possibly plump anymore, they began to glisten. Sparkles appeared at the tips of their fingers, then their hair started to shine, and finally their wings, grown to twice their original size, were shimmering with crystals. "What's happening to you?" "Oh, it's the tide," Minnie said. "We absorb the seawater through our feet, but there's too much salt for us, so it comes out and dries on our skin. The grass does it too, see?" And then I did see it. All the grass around us was covered in crystals. "But what's going to happen to me? Hurry back to the edge of the wetland before the tide comes in all the way." "I will, thank you." "You are right. The wetlands are fun." "But only if you take time to look," they called as they fluttered off, their salty wings shining in the sun. Wetlands are magical places, and now I know that they are filled with wondrous creatures who have found ingenious ways to make the wetlands their home. So find yourself a spot to sit, and if you're quiet enough and still enough, long enough, you may catch a glimpse of the glistening of wings, or you may hear the squelching of tiny feet in the mud. And if you are very, very lucky, and the tide is just right, and if the wind is just so, you, too, will be enchanted by the wetlands. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bomek, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for a few weeks, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Darcy believes in love at first sight. She spent her whole life waiting for that perfect, magical moment. But right now, her life is anything but perfect. After a music festival, she's stranded at a bus station until morning, the day before she leaves for college. Her phone is dead, she has no cash, and she's convinced nothing good can come of this night. But then she meets Russell. Russell, cute and nice, funny and kind. This is the moment and the guy she's been waiting for. And they have until sunrise to walk and talk and connect. Over the course of this one fateful night, filled with football field picnics, night swimming, and escape artist dogs, Darcy and Russell's lives will change forever. They'll discover things they never imagined about each other and about themselves. But can you really know someone after only a handful of hours? Is it possible to fall in love in just one day? And is it worth saying hello when you know you're destined for a goodbye? Okay, last week we learned that Darcy and Russell decide to leave the bus station and walk into town to find a charger for their dead cell phones. And they are both now walking into the western town of Jesse, Nevada. We were at the beginning of a street. What another brown sign, the same style as the one near the bus station, proclaimed as Historic Downtown Jesse, established 1865. On either side, they were low one- and two-story buildings lining the street. They were made of dark red bricks or wood, and seeing this long street, with the mountains rising up behind them, made me feel like I was suddenly living inside one of the many, many westerns my dad had made me watch over the years. We started walking down the street, and I could see that most of the buildings had the raised or curved sections above them that screamed stereotypical Western town, like we just wandered into a movie set. But it didn't look like any of the buildings were general stores or saloons any longer. Some were boarded up, but most seemed to have current businesses in them. A Touch of Class beauty salon, Jesse Chamber of Commerce, this and that resale emporium. But exactly none of these currently looked open. We passed the Prospecting Museum, which was next to the Stagecoach Souvenir Store, both closed. I realized it was getting later on a Sunday, and it maybe didn't seem like Jesse was the most happening town to begin with. But still, we were walking down the center of the street while there were a few cars parked in front of meters. There was nobody driving. So it felt like this was safe. I found I couldn't shake the feeling that we'd wandered back into another time. The iconography of all the buildings and the mountains rising up all around us were familiar in a way I hadn't been expecting. It could have come straight out of Unforgiven, except with lines on either side of the road for cars to park and fire hydrants and no Clint Eastwood looking for revenge. So, when they said historic, Russell said, it seems they meant it. I felt a thrill deep in my bones that he'd been thinking just the same thing I had. I mean, it was right there on the sign. We should have believed them. I looked around, struck by the quietness of the street. It's weird to see it like this, right? What do you mean? Just these buildings are probably the original ones. From like 100 years ago, right? In the middle of whatever boom created this town. Gold? Russell asked, then frowned. Wait, was gold just California? I don't remember. My fourth grade teacher would not be happy. Did you do the gold rush in fourth grade? I'm pretty sure that's when we did the Spanish missions. We did that in sixth. I remember it well because I did a whole presentation in the style of a heist movie, and I called it Mission Impossible. Russell laughed, throwing his head back, and I smiled, feeling something warm spread through my chest. My sixth grade teacher was not a fan. She called my dad and everything. That sounds amazing. I want to see it. I threw it out like so long ago. Well, that's just wrong. It should have been preserved for pun posterity. Did you use the Lalo Schifrin music? Maybe. Is that who did the theme song? Russell nodded. Then yes, that's very impressive. What is? That you know the guy who did the music. Well, I heard a lot about him growing up, believe me. It was... He stopped and pointed to the side of the street. There was a storefront, dark, of course, advertising something called Silver State Adventures. From the illustrated sign, it looked like it booked mine tours and trips to a nearby hot spring. So, it must be silver, right? This is the problem with having a dead phone. I can't Wikipedia Jesse, Nevada. I took a step closer to the store and looked in the window. But it seems like this town must have popped up in a silver boom. They're advertising mine tours of something, after all. And I don't think there were gold mines, were there? Wasn't it just people finding gold in creeks? What's it called, panning? We stared at each other, our shared look of California mineral knowledge becoming clear to both of us, but the term gold mine has come from somewhere, right, I ask? You make an excellent point, and Nevada had to be the silver state for a reason, right? And that's why California is the golden state. I thought we were the golden state because of, like, sunshine. He stared at me, his eyes wide. Have I gotten this wrong my whole life? I feel like I need to rethink everything. I laughed at that, and Russell smiled like he was joining in. We kept walking down the quiet street, and I tried to imagine what it would have been like 150 years ago, before the closed vape store existed, when things would have been at their peak. I tried to picture a town so bustling it couldn't even have imagined an afternoon this deserted. It's funny. What is? Just being here, it's like a place out of time, you know? I was finding my thoughts even as I was speaking them. I'm just thinking about all the people who would have come here. The ones who showed up from other places ready to begin again, find a fortune and start over, become someone else, someone nobody back home could recognize. Russell nodded slowly as he looked around. It seemed like he was turning my words over in his head, which I liked, like he wasn't just jumping in because it was his turn to talk. But that being said, I don't think we're going to find an iPhone charger here. I don't think we're going to find a telegraph charger here. I laughed at that, and Russell grinned at me. Ready for another fun fact? Am I? I said, making my voice comically enthused. The second after I said it, I worried that Russell wouldn't get that I was kidding, like my ex, Alex, never seemed to. But he just smiled wider. It's not exactly related to telegraphs, but it's in the wheelhouse of old-fashioned phones. I'll allow it. So, in the 1940s, people used to call the phone the Amici. The Amici? Yeah, the actor Don Amici had played Alexander Graham Bell in a biopic. And so, it became what people said instead of phone. So what you're saying is that we're looking for an Amici charger? He looked over at me, a smile forming on his face. Exactly. That is a fun fact. How does one even come to be in possession of a fact like that? Well, there was this musical about 10 years ago, The Game of Telephone. Do you know it? No, but that's not saying all that much. I only know, like, three. I meant this as a kind of a joke, but Russell had got shock still, his face grave. Seriously? Yes. I saw Hamilton at the Pantages, and I'm pretty sure the Music Man, too. Russell was still looking shocked by this, so I tried to think of any I'd seen put on at school. The one with the cats? Yeah, that's Cats. And that should not be one of your examples. How is this possible? Well, we weren't big on musicals in my family, I guess. Do Disney movies count? Russell shook his head. No. Sorry. I didn't realize this was such an issue. It's not. I apologize. I know. I can get a little... It's what I want to do. Musicals. To write them, I mean. Oh! His reaction was making more sense now. That's so cool. Like Lin-Manuel Miranda? I was pulling out literally the only musical composer I knew, but hoping it would still get me some credit. Yes, him, Sondheim, Tenine, Tesori, Pasek, and Paul, Michael R. Jackson, the Lopezes. It's my favorite art form. That's really great. I took a breath to ask him if he'd be studying it in college, but then a second later stopped myself because I suddenly realized I didn't know if he was starting school this year like me. I'd assumed he was around my age, but there was a possibility he was already in college, or not in college at all, or, more distressing, that he was a really mature-looking high school sophomore. I was all at once aware of the knowledge gulf between us, one that hadn't seemed to have been there with the fun facts and the puns. I didn't even know where he was from. But was it such a big deal? In so many of these stories, it didn't seem super important. What mattered was how you felt. After all, Marie and Tony didn't know anything about each other before they were declaring their love and inadvertently starting a gang war. West Side Story, I burst out triumphantly. Russell raised an eyebrow. Sorry, I just thought of another musical I know. That did kind of come out of nowhere. I think it came out of somewhere. He just looked at me for a second, and then his face broke open in a smile as he got the joke. I can't even believe you just said that. His eyes were on mine, and his face was full of wonder. Who are you? Darcy, I said, my voice coming out a bit strangled, like the song. My thoughts were spinning in every direction, and if I'd been in a musical myself, I had a feeling this would have been the moment I would have burst into song. Calm down and maybe get some basic facts about this dude, Dee Dee advised, her tone dry. Unnecessary, Katie insisted, sounding swoony. We walked in silence for a few paces, and I tried to think about the best way to do this. I was realizing that most of the time when I'd met someone, there had been context. I was usually meeting someone through school or through a friend, and either way, I had something of a backstory sketched in. I'd almost never just encountered someone out in the world like this, not tethered to anything. The two of us could have been anyone from anywhere. And while I liked that idea in theory, it also meant I wasn't armed with baseline facts. But I wasn't sure how to go about getting them. I didn't think I could just demand, "How old are you?" and "Where do you go to school?" without building up to it a little. After a moment of silent deliberation, I finally asked, "Are you studying musicals in school?" Russell looked down at the ground for a moment. I was about to ask the question again. Maybe he hadn't heard me, or was still reeling from my lack of composer knowledge. But then he turned to me and took a breath. "I am. I got into the musical theater BFA program at University of Michigan. I start next week." "Oh, that's awesome." I was secretly relieved that he was clearly around my age and couldn't help thinking that it was just one more sign that this was meant to be happening. Out of only five people at the bus station, two of us were the same age and had this kind of connection. It meant something. "It means teenagers are more broke than adults," Dee Dee said skeptically. "Ignore her," Katie said with a sigh. "It totally means something." "What about you? Are you going to college?" My stomach sank the way it always did when I thought about what would be happening in about a day and a half. "Yeah, I'm going to Stanwich College." I tried to sound like a normal incoming freshman would, excited about going to school, like Russell had just sounded. I tried not to think about what it would actually mean when I showed up there, or about the note on the brochure that had been sent to me. I pushed all that away and took a breath to begin my explanation, which always seemed to be necessary since most people on the West Coast hadn't heard of a tiny liberal arts college in a nothing burger state. "It's in Connecticut, about an hour outside New York City. Yes, it will be a big change in weather." "In Connecticut, right? Yeah, you've heard of it? My Montana friend of mine knew someone who went there. She talked about it a lot." I nodded, trying to pretend like I hadn't even noticed that "my." I just silently hoped that he was talking about his ex and not a current girlfriend. Because otherwise, would he be out here with me right now? Would my heart be pounding this way if he wasn't feeling something too? I decided this Montana had to be his ex. It didn't make any sense otherwise. "Wow, that's a long way from home," Russell said, then frowned. "Wait, where is home?" I assumed L.A. because of the bus, but L.A., I confirmed, a little bit shocked that we'd gotten this far without establishing this. But I also kind of liked it. It was like, for once, I wasn't being defined by who I was or where I went to school or the people we had in common. Like I could just be. We're in Raven Rock, me and my dad. Russell didn't say anything, which wasn't that shocking. A lot of people hadn't heard of our town, a tiny peaceful pocket in the northeast corner of the city. One main street, farmers market every Friday, and more frozen yogurt shops than made any rational sense. It's about as far east as you can be in L.A. without crossing into Pasadena. College of the West is there, basically, I said with a laugh, falling back on the analogy I'd heard my dad use more than once. Picture Brentwood, then take away all the assholes, drop down a few tax brackets, and that's Raven Rock. Russell looked down and frowned and wondered if he'd just noticed how dusty his chucks had become. "I think I've been there," he said, sounding distracted. There's that hot dog place, right? Walt's? I think so. With the pinball machine? Yes, that's the one. It was so good. It really is. Wait, where are you from? Was there a chance that he lived in Glendale or Highland Park or just a few towns over from me? It didn't seem possible. I felt like I would have heard tell of him. This cute, smart, pun-appreciating guy. If he'd been anywhere near my orbit. Russell stopped, stared down at the state of his shoes, and sighed. "Well, I did try and tell you." "You did?" He looked up at me and shrugged. Well, there's something kind of creepy about two perfect sneakers anyway, don't you think? Like you can tell they've just been boxed away and never worn. He frowned like he was trying to call something to mind. "Sorry, you asked me something?" "Yeah, where are you from?" "Oh, we live in Ojai," he said, naming a town 2 hours' drive outside L.A., me and my mom and dad. "Oh, hi there," I responded immediately, which was the joke I made basically when anyone said the name of that town. "Sorry, I bet you're sick of hearing that." "Oh, you get used to it. It's practically the town's motto." "I can't believe you live there." "I'd only been once, 2 years ago, when my dad and I went there to attend his friend Dave's second wedding. But it had immediately seemed magical. The rolling green hills, the tiny perfect downtown, the outdoor bookshop, the people riding around on beach cruisers. All at once, I could picture Russell there, biking through downtown, the breeze ruffling his curls. And the fact that he lived in Ojai meant we definitely didn't know any of the same people. A second later, I realized how much I liked this. I didn't want to play who do you know. I didn't want to find out that Russell knew Katie's former soccer teammate or Dee Dee's ex-girlfriend's sister. We were in a historic downtown in the middle of Nevada, late in the afternoon on a Sunday, with the most beautiful mountains I'd ever seen surrounding us. There was nobody else around, and in the light that was just starting to fade, it seemed like maybe we were the only two people on Earth, and that all of this had been conjured just for us. "So, have you always been in Ojai?" He looked over at me and I shrugged. "It just seems like a long drive for hot dogs." I mean, they were really good hot dogs. Oh, this is true. We were in L.A. occasionally. I think my mom had read about Walt's somewhere and wanted to make a pilgrimage. But yeah, it's just the three of us in the same house I grew up in. He laughed. Pretty boring, huh? I shook my head. I could see it, Russell hiding his bike up a cute, cozy cottage, a perfect small-town life. Your parents are still married? I wasn't quite able to keep a note of something. Envy? Longing? Out of my voice when I asked this. Yes, he said, then hesitated. I mean, kind of. They're still together, but they weren't ever technically married. Oh, I said, not sure what to say to this. Russell looked over at me and laughed, then started walking again. I fell into step with him, our feet falling at the same time, like it was the easiest thing in the world. They thought they were on this boat and got married by who they thought was the captain. But then later, they found out it was just a random waiter who didn't have the authority to marry anyone. I've always thought it so weird that sea captains have the authority to marry people. Well, you've always thought that? I laughed, but kept going. Yes, like, why is it this one job in transportation that gives you this power? Why not train conductors or bus drivers? Well, I have never thought about it unless you, who has always thought about it. I stand by what I said. I guess, Russell tilted his chin up, looking at the sky like he was thinking, maybe it's because sea voyages used to be really long. And it's not like on trains where you'd be stopping in places where there would be ministers or rabbis or judges or whatever. So it was more necessary. But these random ship people couldn't wait until they got back on dry land. They had to be married in the middle of the ocean. And unfortunately, this is where we're going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with a fascinating novel titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.